The work of this church in the world is realized through the generous financial support of all who call this place home. Along with the gifts and time and talent, ours is a shared ministry. You have a role to play here. Church membership is open to all. For more information, go to uusf.org.
I had a phone call recently from my sister Kristen in San Diego. Out of the blue, she said to me, "Have you ever heard of Henry Whitney Bellows?" Bellows, I thought. Well, of course I have. Thinking of the Civil War era minister of All Souls Unitarian Church in New York City. He and Thomas Starr King worked closely together to raise loads of money for the Sanitary Commission that saved so many lives in the Civil War. And my sister had come across him at random. And when I was telling her about Bellows, what came to mind is the image of your baptismal font and seeing it in my mind's eye here in this sanctuary and remembering that this font was a gift from Bellows and that congregation to Thomas Starr King and this congregation. When Thomas Starr King was still alive. And in fact, in one of his last sermons of his untimely short life, he preached about the baptismal font. I haven't read the sermon. Maybe John has it. But one of the other little curious things is what Vanessa was pointing out, that carved along the edges of the font are the faces of Thomas Starr King and Henry Whitney Bellows. King's nose is kind of chipped off there, and Bellows looks in pretty good shape, and they're both facing the back. You should probably someday turn them around facing all of you, so you can see their faces. Bellows even came west to help this congregation after the untimely death of Thomas Starr King. Well, Bellows and King can just pop out of the past when you least expect it. When we review history and get familiar with it, we know more clearly who we are. And isn't that the value of your celebration of 175 years as a congregation? To know better who you are, whence we come, and how, and whither. Such an event is also a chance to bring out an old relic like me, someone who first stood in this pulpit 5 decades ago. Compare me to the photo that hangs in the church somewhere to see the impact of time and aging. Change and continuity are woven fine. I arrived here just after the 125th anniversary, and hearing about it introduced me to the history of this congregation. Your earliest ministers, sadly, were felled by Panama fever and diphtheria in their prime, short ministries, lots of them. Thanks to routine vaccines, we don't worry about those threats. In our time, we've had to contend with HIV and COVID-19 epidemics. But luckily, I've survived to be back for your 175th. When you celebrate your bicentennial, I will be among what the Bible calls the great cloud of witnesses, the ancestors who embrace you all about and lead you onto the path that you should follow. Whenever a congregation's story is longer than any one person's lifespan, it's easy to see how we all enter and leave the flowing stream, buoyed by a story that was here before us and will go on after us. My tenure in your stream was just 5 years. It's 3% of your history. And yet, much happened in that short time. I so appreciate the chance to be here and to be remembering these times, your strong and multifaceted senior minister, Vanessa Southern. I'm so appreciative. She hosted me this weekend and pulled the dots together for me. I thank the anniversary committee members and all of you for being here. I'm so grateful to John Buehrens for writing the history of this church, updating prior efforts, and putting your story in the larger context, because the forebears in this congregation significantly shaped history. Just imagine if Thomas Starr King had not done so much to save California for the Union. What a different nation we might be. My time here did not even dent national destiny. Few ministers do. The tumultuous events of those times shaped us. November of 1978, untethered reality. The Jonestown Massacre in Guyana of over 900 people, including Congressman Leo Ryan and others in his delegation. It was bizarrely far away and close to home. It was horrible in every way. People's Temple was located there where they'd left from, was just west of us here on Geary, a cult undercover. And then just 9 days later, the assassinations of Mayor Moscone and Supervisor Harvey Milk rocked us to the core. And within 3 years, the virus that caused the AIDS epidemic was the new enemy attacking from within. Today, in these times, may we remember that we have faced terrible situations before. What we did mattered then and now. 8 years ago, I preached here on the 40th anniversary of my ordination. I found that sermon in my computer and I thought, wow, that's sweet, as in saccharine sweet. I was here during tumultuous times and that sermon made it sound like a picnic love feast. Well, believe me, I had some wonderful picnics and lovely times here. I fell in love and I was married here on this chancel, but I left out two of the important challenging themes of that time, being the first woman in the ministry of this congregation, and the ways that money, or lack thereof, limited this congregation's impact. So today, the rest of the story from my personal vantage point. And as Vanessa said, she printed up copies of that earlier sermon, and they're out on a table if you'd like to look at it. I came to this congregation young, and which is why I'm still here, and unfamiliar with urban ministry. Cambridge and Boston were urban, but in Massachusetts, I'd been trained in congregations in leafy suburbs. Here, I was hit by the pace and the complexity, the number of people, the many cultures, and of course, the beauty. San Francisco was a wonder and a nonstop adventure, and this church for me was the hub of the wheel. It's hard to remember how shocking it was back then to encounter a woman in ministry. We were then about 3% of the clergy in our whole tradition. Today, women are well over half. Mason Ingram, who now lives in Colorado, he's in his 90s, told me that he still winces when he remembers first meeting me. He had joined the congregation in 1961 during the ministry of Harry Meserve, and then he was away for several years. When Mason moved back to the city, he came by the church right away and asked to see the minister. When I appeared, Mason looked at me, paused, and then asked to see the real minister. I have no memory of that first meeting with Mason because, frankly, that kind of thing happened pretty often. Sometimes I felt like a novelty and other times invisible. Gay men were having similar shifts in identity. This church was a place of safety from the risks of being outed. Lesbians were more under the radar, but still suffered the oppression of stereotypes and homophobia. David Harrell, who now lives in Texas, was one of the leaders in establishing The Caucus. The group name was originally just The Caucus because people were afraid to call it the Gay Caucus. One time, McDonald Sardison was doing a program, and he was a very popular travel agent, and his program was about traveling while gay, but it was simply publicized, avoiding sensitive words at the time, as a travel program. Many elderly women of the congregation joined in to hear Mac's program, and he kind of looked at his crowd and went right ahead with what he was going to talk about. The women, of course, took it in stride. And after that, the caucus remained open to everyone, but calling it the Gay Caucus made clear its focus. Large numbers of people attended before church on Sunday mornings. At the start of my time here, I picked up some anxiety in the congregation about having me in the pulpit. There were passing references people made to fragility under pressure. Eventually, I learned that there had been a woman intern who, in her preaching debut here, a student, had a breakdown during her service. I don't know, but she might have been one of the first women ever to speak from this pulpit. But that was people's frame of reference. They were anxious. Could I handle the pressure? Well, there was pressure here, and one kind of pressure was people who disrupted services. You may have heard about Jesus Christ Satan, who terrorized my first candlelit Christmas Eve service. I told that story last time I was here, and it's in that printed sermon. There were other occasions when I was physically threatened or attacked. Mark Bellatini, the first out gay minister to serve one of our UU churches, was stalked for a long time, and his life was seriously threatened. Disruption was real, reflecting the tumult and the problems of the times. We have been leaders breaking down bias about gender and orientation, and there is still work to do. For clergy who are transgender or live with disabilities or have an accent, still have a hard time being called to our congregations and seen for who they are. Preaching. One Saturday evening, I was struggling at my typewriter with my sermon for the next day, and I began to feel alarmingly ill. My heart was pounding. I called up my sister Karen in Boston, and I told her I was all by myself and thought maybe I should go to the emergency room in case I could be having a heart attack. She listened to my symptoms. I couldn't concentrate on my sermon. I had a premonition that something terrible was about to happen. She asked me a number of questions. Have you eaten? What have you eaten? Well, I explained that there was nothing to eat in the apartment, but I had found a tin of brownies in the freezer belonging to my roommate, and I'd been eating them. Okay. Is there a chance those were Alice B. Toklas brownies? And so it dawned on me that I was stoned. Slow to catch on. Go to bed, Karen told me. Forget about your sermon. Just get some sleep. I hope everyone in the church the next morning was likewise able to forget about my sermon, whatever it was. To this day, I am not fond of chocolate. I sometimes even now wake up in the middle of the night and cringe at the memory of something I did here. A large group of 30-some newcomers, eager adults, gathered in the fireside room for a new member orientation class that I was to lead. I ran out of material and resorted to reading to them from the UUA directory about organizations that were under our umbrella. I read to them from the UU phone book. Did I tell them why I loved this tradition? Did I ask them about what they were seeking, what they wanted to contribute here? Did I suggest we wrap up early? Nope, I didn't. But despite my blunders, and there were many, the church was drawing in newcomers. Luckily, they could see that the church was about more than the newbie minister. I arrived to be the assistant minister with the late David Rankin. When he went on to Atlanta, the leadership here trusted me to fill the role of interim senior minister for the next 2 years. We brought in Mark Bellatini, brilliant Mark Bellatini, and two students, Barbara Peskin and Mark DeWolf. We worked together as a close team, a quartet of pastoral and prophetic clergy. We were in and out making home and hospital visits, attending community meetings, and many church programs. We managed to the transition to Stan Stefancic, the new called minister, as the senior minister. 1 year later, I accepted a call to Belmont, Massachusetts, where I had a successful ministry and was later named Minister Emerita. I had some survivor's guilt for having left just prior to the AIDS crisis. In my final months of 1981 in the summer, a parishioner drove himself to the hospital in Marin with a strange malady the doctors couldn't identify. He died there a few weeks later. Who knows what it was, but so many lives were taken in the following years, including Mark DeWolf, who'd been the student here, Mark of blessed memory. My life had changed, first with a baby and then another, and a very busy church in Massachusetts. But a piece of my soul was here. Remembering again from the times I was the minister here, we have authority by virtue of our office and all that entails. But sometimes people dismissed me anyway because I was a woman. In those days, the center was in constant use by congregational groups and rented by many organizations. Est drew large crowds for long weekend seminars, and they had a bad reputation with our sextons. One Friday night at 10:30, I was in my study, and the sexton came to tell me that Est wasn't leaving. Their contract said that they would end at 10, and he needed to close up the center. He had told them to leave and had been ignored. I went with him, and together we told the leader that they needed to wrap up and stop, and we got that Est brush off. "We'll take responsibility," they said. "We take responsibility." Well, they went on talking into their microphone, and I asked the sexton to show me the main electrical panel. And I flipped off the power to the building. The Est people went quiet and stumbled out in the dark. I understood my invisible ministerial powers in terms of soul and pastoral presence, caring and listening, and what the congregation had entrusted to me. And on occasion, I needed to locate power in more literal ways. The Hathaway Fund for Benevolence is now defunct, but it existed to help people in a crisis. However, word had gotten out on the street, and we had a steady stream of non-church people looking for cash who came in and waited around outside the office. The routine was that when I had a break in my schedule, the receptionists would send them to me, and I would listen to their story, decide if they'd get some cash, and they'd get money on the way out. I thought the church should hire a social worker instead of having me spend time on what felt like one little tiny scam after another, because I was getting jaded about the stories I was told, and it wasn't good for my spiritual qualities of compassion and understanding. One evening, when I was leaving late and walked from the office into the gallery, a crowd of people waiting there for handouts asked me, "Is the minister still here?" I know it wasn't what Jesus would do, but I smiled and I said, "I'm so sorry, he left hours ago." And exhausted, I left the building. You know, it's so curious that there's a penny sitting up here on the chancel, and I'm going to talk about money, a lot more than a penny, but I don't know, is it a lucky penny, random penny, throwaway penny, I don't know. But money was a significant factor in my time here. Indeed, throughout the history of this congregation, on a personal level, I wasn't paid enough to live on. In 1976, I was offered $10,000 a year, which seemed quite plausible to someone who'd been a grad student. But if you use a value calculator of what that means in today's dollars, it clearly wasn't enough to live on, even with my frugal habits and simple needs. So I took on weddings to make ends meet. Weddings that took up so much time. They were lovely occasions, but took all weekend, and they took time away from what I could be doing with the congregation. I did over 200 weddings in my 5 years here. This was not a strategy for church growth. I hadn't gone into ministry to make money, but the lack of it was distracting from what I was called to do. The UUA did an annual survey of compensation, and they wrote to tell me that I was the lowest full-time minister in their annual survey. Congregations have a tendency to look for leadership as cheaply as they can find it. But consider for a moment what a corporation would do. They wouldn't search for the cheapest CEO available. And they wouldn't be proud of saving money that way. It's always a stress in congregations to balance the generosity of congregations with the expansiveness of our hopes and dreams. I did work very hard, ridiculously long hours, and from that came some successes. One example was the Holly Near concert. I wrote to Holly. Some of you will remember her and maybe have heard her more recently. I wrote to invite her to come and sing in this congregation, and she accepted. The evening concert in the sanctuary sold out quickly to her largely female fan base. Holly, who had grown up north of here in the Redwoods, sang a stunning concert beneath this magnificent ceiling. Because she was close to home, her parents came, and they sat in the fourth row. I found it very endearing. A committee from the church and several of my friends from the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley helped make it happen. The church was packed, and people were sitting in the aisles and, of course, in the entire choir loft. The church netted about $2,000 in profit, real money in those days, but most importantly, it gave the church visibility within the lesbian and feminist community as a welcoming place. Clergy are the figureheads, but the real power in the congregation comes from the members and the volunteers and the contributors, from the choir and the staff, and especially dedicated lay leaders. It comes from you. That was true when that original congregation was formed, and it is true today. I talked with people who used to be members here before they went on to new places in their lives, and more than one person said to me, "That church saved my life." A former Catholic said that he thought a bolt of lightning was going to come down and strike him for sitting in the pews in this church. What a relief when it did not. And his religious fears lessened. One of them hadn't known the word sanctuary before, but soon found that he did not want to leave after services because this place had become a sanctuary from his chaotic life outside these walls. Another said, "I don't know who I would be if it weren't for my 6 years at First UU." What happens here changes lives for the better. This community saves lives. Whether through theological revelations or small gestures or routines, people find safety and truth and meaning that fits who they are. This is our faith. It helps keep the big picture in view, keeps the heart loving even through tumult, and builds connections from person to person, from generation to generation, across time and distance. Amen. The Reverend Harry Meserve wrote a prayer that is in the back of the Silver Hymn Book, and I think the words of it still speak to us today. From arrogance, pompousness, and from thinking ourselves more important than we are, may some saving sense of humor liberate us. For allowing ourselves to ridicule the faith of others, may we be forgiven. From making war and calling it peace, special privilege and calling it justice, indifference and calling it tolerance, pollution and calling it progress, may we be cured. For telling ourselves and others that evil is inevitable while good is impossible, may we stand corrected. God of our mixed up, tragic, aspiring, doubting, and insurgent lives, help us to be as good in our hearts as we have always wanted to be. Amen. David Rankin was your senior minister here for 6 years, 1973 to 79. David died last year. I miss him. Working with David for 2 years was a great gift to me as a new minister. He was an amazing person. When David accepted a call to Atlanta, we had a farewell Sunday service, and this is part of what I said in that service. "David, you combine the manner of a humble cleric with the worldly sophistication of an urban scholar. You have the work ethic of a 19th century Calvinist, along with a zany playfulness of the Marx brothers. You practice the discipline of daily meditation and emerge full of renegade ideas of a free thinker. You hold to Christian faith, but let go of self-righteous pieties. You have an inviolate sense of privacy, yet reveal from the pulpit the deeply personal core of your life. You espouse the ideals of faith and the religious tradition, fully understanding human frailty. You are biting and harsh in your condemnation of the evils of our time, while compassionate in your dealings with every human being. If you knew David, I hope those sound right as a description of his heart and soul.